with various bills listed on the agenda. Council will tell the committee what the bills do, and then if there's someone available who would like to tell us why we need the bill, we'll bring them up and have them tell us that, and then we'll move on. So first one will be a public hearing on Senate Bill 47, Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 47 is a bill that what it does is it delays the imposition of interest on some criminal judgments until July 1, 2007. This bill deals with court facilities, and in 99 there was an agreement made between counties and the state on how to take care of suitable courthouses that the county would have the responsibility, and then the state would provide the personal property and the supplies and kind of the and that end of it. And these statutes that are mentioned are basically the funding mechanism for those accounts that would go into that go into paying for that. And my understanding is the request is that we delay the beginning of that until 2007 so that the parties can figure out how to do this properly.
All right, who's my first victim to come up? Tell me about this. Paul, my dear friend. You want to bring... Okay, Brad's coming up too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and the council, I think, has fairly characterized the bill. It was a bill that both the Judicial Department and AOC advocated for, developed. The trouble is that it related to circumstances in 1999, which was a time when I heard that this is the most extensive period of economic growth in our times that we've ever gone through. There was a lone voice in the wilderness by the name of Alan Greenspan who was talking about irrational exuberance and nobody was paying any attention. Well, times have changed. And although we thought we would be on track to implement this legislation, which is the reason why we chose a 4-day delayed effective date, we are not on track any longer to implement it. This is a law that we advocated for, that we want to be implemented, and that we will continue to work to implement if you pass Senate Bill 47. But at this point in time, it does not appear to be something that can be implemented, given the financial situation of justice courts, municipal courts, and circuit courts. So we would respectfully ask you to pass Senate Bill 47.
Brad, any wisdom?
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm special counsel for government relations with the State Court Administrator's Office. A year ago, this bill was on, this concept was on our work through list. The counties came to us and said that their analysts were telling them they couldn't get it done in time, they didn't have the issues. By the end of June last year, we no longer had the resources to completely implement this, and because of budget cuts to our agency, so it came off of our work list. It looks like we will not be getting that in this budget. We will get further cuts and will not have the resources. We had no policy, no problem with the original policy decision made by the legislature. We just don't currently have the resources to do it. We hope to continue to work on the concept, but we don't see a possibility of additional resources to do this until probably not the next biennium, but the following biennium. So we're hoping for a delay to avoid the litigation that would happen if we don't end up doing what the law directs we do.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions by the committee?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
I had Jed Limhouse, who runs the Justice Court in Harrisburg, come and talk to me yesterday, and he gave me a better explanation than either of you two. I'm sorry. He told me that the problem was the difficulty in distributing the interest. So maybe you could talk to that. He says that there are so many different accounts that the fines go to, and it's hard to figure out the interest rate, and it takes a massive computer program to do that, and that's the reason we need the delay. Does that make sense to either of you?
Chairman, Senator Walker, that's exactly the resources that we do not have to do. It's the computer resources to do the reprogramming, to handle the hundreds of thousands of cases that we have, and to allocate the interest on different parts in each case, and that's what is here.
Right. Senator Ferriola.
Judge Limhouse made the same visit, and I thought his explanation was persuasive and simple. We just can't calculate, number one, who owns the interest, and number two, what is the interest. I'm a little confused.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, as
yes.
long as we're on this topic.
Sure.
At the current time, people holding judgments for child support go to the courts or the district attorneys to get enforcement orders on arrearages, and they are told to go calculate the interest owed. The person holding the judgment is responsible for going out and hiring a CPA to calculate the interest owed on those accounts currently. And that also is a system that seems utterly and completely irrational.
So right.
You know, if we're in the neighborhood and we're going to do something about calculating interest, I wish we could look at a little bigger system to provide some empowerment for the courts and for the enforcement community so that these things are a keystroke away from an answer as opposed to sending somebody in a loop, especially people that can't afford to do that. You're looking at me in a confused way.
Chairman, it's Senator Ferriola. Not at all. I mean, there are a lot of things that we would like our system to be able to do. That it doesn't currently do.
And Mr. Chairman, automatic interest calculations are rocket science. Every pocket calculator can do it. The court apparently can't do it.
Well, we had a bill yesterday in the General Government Committee that set up an office of outsourcing or privatization. Maybe beneficial finance or household finance could do the interest calculations. I don't know. They seem to be able to calculate complex interest schemes. So,
Mr. Chairman, if you had a call from a person who has a judgment against a recalcitrant ex-spouse who's in arrears and behind, and she's asking for an enforcement order to get the collections, including interest, and somebody in the court system tells her, well, we can't calculate the interest. You'll have to hire a CPA or an accountant to do that and bring us back the calculations, and then we'll put the order in. That's just not, that is not a good system.
Actually, it kind of reminds me of the police department in a sense where it's getting so bad we're thinking about sending out your own evidence collection kits to victims so they can do their own crime scene investigation.
Mr. Chairman, are those similar to the earthquake kits that legislators would give power under their desks with?
Yeah, follow the directions. Anyway, thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Thank
we'll
you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 47. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 426.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 426 would add local parking enforcement regulation personnel. If you cause physical injury to one of those people, it would be assault in the third degree. So they would get the same protections as, say, a staff member at the jails, or a taxi driver, or a paramedic. So that's the symbol 426,
all right.
Adding to assault in the third degree.
All right. Susan, do you want to come and talk to us about this bill?
Mr. Chair, here is the City of Portland. I think that your council has summarized it accurately, and that the desire is to put these parking patrol deputies essentially on the same footing.
I'm sorry,
can you speak up?
I'm sorry. Susan Schneider, City of Portland. Your council summarized it very well, and it's essentially to put parking patrol deputies in the same category as these other folks in terms of the kind of protection and prosecution as possible.
Are we having a problem in Portland with assaults on parking deputies? Or?
My understanding from the parking patrol people is that they feel they are. I don't have any data for you.
All right. I've actually tried to enforce the parking statutes from time to time. You do, Rick, end up with some very hostile individuals. Don't want you to write that $25 ticket. It's amazing, actually.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Susan. Appreciate your time. We'll close.
Mr. Chairman, I thought you had diplomatic immunity.
I have never claimed diplomatic immunity. Professional courtesy, perhaps.
Well, I once yelled out a window at a parking person who was about ready to give me a ticket and said, I'll be right down.
Close the public hearing. Senate Bill 426, and we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 592.
Mr. Chairman, Symbol 592 relates to a plant called Salvia divinorum, which I went on the internet last night and found it is a plant. It's also known as diviner's sage, which gives you an idea. It's a hallucinogen. that I guess is similar to mescaline or the mushrooms that you take. But it's from Mexico, and it's been around a long time. And this is all the internet, so I hope that it's accurate. But
it's not firsthand knowledge.
No, it's not firsthand. I never heard of this before, and I prosecuted drug cases for a long time.
Mr. Chairman, if the counsel of this committee had any ability at all to divine, he wouldn't.
Right, I was going to say. But that tea was a little funny this morning. At any rate, this would make it unlawful to deliver this plant to a person under the age of 21. And would make that a Class A misdemeanor.
All right, and this is Senator Devlin's bill. I don't know if there's anyone here from Senator Devlin's office or other interested parties. He didn't want to preserve this. So
I was just. Sure, no, they saw a salvia plant at Fred Meyer.
Yeah.
Might be a different strain, but I'm not sure. Maybe Craig, you can check that out.
And is it okay to
I'll
have
go lick the plants and see.
It seems to be okay to buy it if you're over 21.
Correct. They would not. Yes.
I just think if people want to get high on life, they just show up in the legislature and watch all the fine work going on here. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 592. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 615.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 615 deals with statute of limitations on child sexual abuse cases. This would extend, if a claim was barred, one of these type of claims was barred only because the statute of limitations had run, this would extend the statute of limitations to December 31st, 2004. The provision, the bill only applies to a claim of child sexual abuse against a person that owed a duty of care to the plaintiff and that alleges that a negligent act or omission of the defendant was a legal cause of the childhood sexual abuse, and the claim was based against any person alleging that an intentional act or omission of the defendant was a legal cause of the child sexual abuse.
All right. Is there anyone here on Senate Bill 615? Would you like to come up and give us a few comments?
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Deborah Holton. I'm the Sexual Assault Prevention Specialist for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And the coalition strongly supports Senate Bill 615, which revives the child sex abuse cases past the statute of limitations when the accused owed a duty of care to the plaintiff victim. Because child sex abuse victims often have no way to escape or seek assistance, they cope with the abuse by denying or forgetting its reality. These coping strategies are magnified when a child is abused, often repeatedly by a caretaker. Because that person also provides shelter, food, and the child's only experience of love and nurturance, children cannot deal with or admit the damage being done by that individual, who may also use threats to silence victims. The ability to tell oneself the full truth of the abuse or understand the resulting harm often comes long after the abuse has ended. The fact that children's coping strategies help abusers keep the secret shouldn't serve as a shield which keeps abusers from ever being held accountable. Reviving claims when plaintiffs not only fail to protect children but use positions of trust and protection to access victims sends a message that our courts will not protect abusers if only they can keep their victims silent long enough. Since most abusers have several victims, the ability to charge an individual for abuse in the past can prevent current or future abuse. The coalition urges the Senate to pass Senate Bill 615. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Any questions? Senator Walker.
Mr. Chair, I do hope that we continue to hear this bill. Having been a survivor myself, I'm very interested in pursuing this matter further.
Actually, I promise this will be a fascinating series of discussions on issues like repressed memory and the value of those kinds of evidences in court, et cetera. So it'll be fascinating.
And may I just add, it isn't just about repressed memory. Mm-hmm. Often it's about understanding fully what happened and the implications.
I know. I've investigated these cases before. And
okay.
It will be interesting, trust me.
Thank you.
It gets fascinating. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. And we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 615. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 619. Council.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 619 deals with putting into effect in Oregon an answer to State versus Atkins. This is a case that says that It is a violation of the Eighth Amendment of the United States and cruel and unusual punishment to put to death a person who is mentally retarded. That case came out last summer, and this is a placeholder so that if we can get the parties to agree on how to implement, how that's decided, who decides it, when it's decided, what review there is, then we'll have a vehicle for that. If no bill is passed, then the courts would have to decide on how to implement the decision that the U.S. Supreme Court handed down.
And just so the committee knows, the prosecution and the defense attorneys have been fighting about this for the last 3 months, trying to figure out how to make it work. So if they do come to resolution, we'll have a bill. If not, we won't. All right. Anybody here want to talk about 619? No? Close public hearing on Senate Bill 619 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 655.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 655, Mr. Hughes is here for this bill. This would, and it's sponsored by Senator Starr, this bill deals with the trafficking in communication devices. It would deal with the fact that now we have more technology with the Internet and broadband technologies, deal with piracy of those communication devices, and would prohibit a person from using those access devices.
All right, Mr. Hughes.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill, or keeping the bill alive this morning. Senate Bill 655 was introduced at the request of the Motion Picture Association of America, one of my clients. And the Motion Picture Association of America is the producers and distributors of motion picture and television. They caused this bill to be introduced around the state. It's hoped to be a model bill introduced throughout the country. And it is being introduced throughout the country. When they drafted the bill, they did not have all the stakeholders at the table. Since it has been introduced, people such as Verizon, Intel, American Electronics Association have all expressed interest, so the National Association has put together a work group in D.C. of all of these folks, and we hope to come back again before this committee with a consensus bill.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Hughes? Now's your time to abuse him if you'd like. No.
Thank you.
Ted, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 655 and open a public hearing on another gem of a bill sponsored by Senator Devlin, Senate Bill 679.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 679 deals with the use of or sale of tobacco to a person it used to be a person under 18. This would raise it to a person under 21 years of age. It's my understanding this would prohibit the sale of tobacco to a person who's under 21 and would also prohibit that person from actually possessing tobacco except for in their own private residence. Spoke with Senator Devlin's assistant and believe that there would be amendments to deal with, for example, military personnel. So. Senate Bill 679.
All right. Anyone here who would like to talk on Senate Bill 679? There's no one. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 679. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 752. Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 752 comes to you from the Department of Justice, and it would create a sexual assault task force and funds for the sexual assault, a sexual assault victims emergency medical response fund.
All right, and do we have anyone here who wants to testify on that? Ms. Hughes again. Yeah, I'm not sure if I pronounced your name.
Holden.
That was Ted Hughes who just left.
Thank you, Chairman. And I apologize. I realize in my written testimony I referred to this as House Bill 752, so please forgive me.
No, we'll have to castigate you for that.
The coalition also strongly supports passage of Senate Bill 752, establishing the fund to pay for forensic and medical exams of sexual assault victims. The previous failure to provide funds for such exams often results in victims being presented with bills for evidence collection and left alone to negotiate with police, hospitals, and insurance companies over the resulting charges. Sexual assault is one of the few crimes, if not the only one, which requires such exhaustive medical corroboration from a living victim. Corroboration desired, if not required, by the criminal justice system. To require a victim to undergo such an invasive process, which is not needed to ensure health or safety, and then pass along the cost, sends a strong message that the system is not interested in mitigating further victimization. Victims, their families, and communities become more reluctant to report and prosecute when they know they have to pay for justice to proceed. The fact that the fund will not use monies from the general fund should make it acceptable, even in these trying political and economic times. Please consider passage of Senate Bill 752. Thank you.
All right. Thank you again, Ms. Holton. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions? There's none. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 752 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 792.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 792 is sponsored by Senator Carter as chief sponsor. This bill relates to contractor liens, and it says that if a owner of a residence has work done on a residence and they can show that they paid the original contractors in full for the work that was done on the residence, then that is a complete bar against a construction or contractor's lien that would encumber the property. I think the goal is not letting subcontractors encumber a property if the owner of the home paid the general contractor in full.
All right. Thank you very much. This is actually a bill that appears, I think, every session. Mm-hmm. A constant battle, but Senator Carter did want to have the bill preserved and would like to have the discussion. So we'll accommodate her. Is there anyone here who wants to talk on this particular bill? There is not, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 792. That gets us through our public hearing portion. We'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 880.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senate Bill 880 comes to us, and it deals with tobacco litigation. This measure deals with the fact of situations where there's a private plaintiff that receives a judgment against a tobacco manufacturer, and then the tobacco manufacturer seeks to have the judgment have a stay on the judgment and appeal it. And this would contemplate how much of a bond, basically, the tobacco company would have to place to be able to do that, to stay the judgment. Mr. Gardner's here. He's a lot more knowledgeable about this than I am. There are some dash 2 and 3 amendments to this bill that I've placed in front of you. And what I'd ask, Mr. Chair, is that we just let Mr. Gardner explain those, because I think he'd probably do a better job.
All right, great. Jim?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Gardner & Gardner, and I'm here today on behalf of Philip Morris. Let me just preface, if I may, Mr. Chairman, my comments on the particulars of the bill with a statement that we are involved in a comprehensive effort this session to attempt to preserve the state's ability to receive funds, both on the tax side and on the MSA side, from the industry, funds which we think are obviously vital to the functioning of state government, and in particular to programs like the Oregon Health Plan. On the House side, there are bills which are aimed at strengthening the non-participating manufacturers' escrow requirements. These are companies that were not signatories to the MSA, but that are distributing products in the state of Oregon and are required to contribute to an escrow. There's legislation on that, which is primarily sponsored by the Department of Justice, which we're assisting on. There's another bill, a Department of Revenue bill on the House side, which is aimed at tightening up collections of taxes. And this bill, which is our responsibility, is aimed at ensuring the flow of MSA money to the state of Oregon. One of the documents that I passed out to you is a Wall Street Journal article that, that really shows the degree to which the states, for better or worse, have become dependent on this, this flow of revenue, which is what we're trying to protect. The other is a memorandum from the Washington, D.C. law firm of Covington & Burling, which is not national counsel, to Philip Morris. And it goes through the problem that has developed with some of the mega verdicts, $100 billion plus in Florida, $12 billion in Illinois, which are typically large class actions, which are simply unbondable. They're not. We cannot afford to bond these judgments. And as a result of that, the company has recently issued a letter to the attorneys general indicating that essentially unless we're successful in reducing the bond amount from the full $12 billion in the Illinois case to an amount that we can afford, we probably we are not able to assure the states that we will make the April 15th payment under the MSA requirements. And I think I can go further than that, as the memorandum does, and say that that if that bond is not reduced, it's a trigger for Chapter 11. Now, why is that important to the state of Oregon? An amicus brief was filed recently by a number of attorney generals, including the Attorney General of Oregon, in the Illinois case, Madison County case, and an attachment to that shows what the payment to the state of Oregon on April 15th is supposed to be, and it's $30 million. That's this biennium. That's money that's already essentially been committed. Those payments have been securitized under bonds that are that I should have already been sold this week. And those, because the state of Oregon was attempting to lower the interest rates on those bonds, those are general obligation bonds, which means that that amount, it represents the debt service on those bonds. And if we're not able to come up with the money under our MSA obligations, the general fund will. And that's simply a that's simply the first bit of bad news that a Chapter 11 would cause, not only for us but for the state of Oregon. In response to that that difficulty, we are pushing all over the country legislation similar to Senate Bill 880. I want to start by saying what Senate Bill 880 is not. It is not a cap on damages. It is not a cap or limitation on damages. It is a limitation on the bond, the supersedious appeal bond that we have to post to get into appellate court. Now, the history of tobacco litigation is that very frequently large judgments in trial courts are either reversed or the damages drastically limited on appeal. But in order for that to occur, and thus for us to be able to continue to make our payment obligations under the MSA, we first got to get into appellate court. And if you can't afford the bond to get into appellate court, Chapter 11 is the only alternative. The Senate Bill 880, as printed, would set the a maximum amount of appeal bond at the lesser of $25 million or $1 million plus 10% of the judgment in excess of $1 million. Because of concerns, which I think you will hear from the Attorney General today and others, that the $25 million is too low a figure, we have presented amendments, the dash threes, which raise that figure to $100 million. And that's at the high end of all similar legislation currently in existence around the country. 15 states have already passed legislation like this and a number of others because of the threat that's represented by Illinois and other sort of similar decisions are now pursuing it. The other amendment, the Dash 2 amendments, is a technical amendment clarifying that this legislation applies in situations similar to the Illinois situation, and that the essence of the claim in that case is that the marketing of light cigarettes is inherently misrepresentative because they cause harm as well. So that amendment is intended to cover situations like the Illinois situation. Now, why Oregon? Why should we do this when some other states have not yet, and some other states are simply considering it, and when the question is still in doubt of what's going to happen in the Illinois legislature and in the Illinois court? And the answer to that is that, as documented in the Covington memo, Oregon is one of a handful of hotspot states where verdicts similar in scope and theory to the Illinois verdict are very much a possibility. There is a class case pending, class certification not yet granted, where the exact same legal theory is raised as is raised in the Illinois decision. Pat, I cannot guarantee you, to be completely honest, the passage of this legislation will avert Chapter 11 because we still have the Illinois situation. We have other states. But what I can say is if we are successful in a sufficient number of states and in the state of Illinois in reducing that bond amount, our odds of keeping the revenue flow to the state of Oregon intact is substantially improved. With that, let me close and ask for questions. Mr. Chairman. Right.
Any questions of Mr. Gardner?
Mr. Chair, I think it's been shown that the tobacco companies have lied to the American people. That's been shown in a number of court cases. So why is it that we should believe the tobacco companies that they're just going to go into Chapter 11 if we don't do this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, let me have offered a two-part answer to that. The direness of the situation is perhaps best confirmed by the fact that a number of attorney generals from around the country, including the Attorney General of Oregon, have filed an amicus brief in the Illinois case asking that the bond be reduced and stating the consequences to the states if that is done. Second, we have filed with the Illinois court and with the attorney generals under seal internal financial information allowing them and their auditors to verify that statement.
All right. Other questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. If the reason that you are seeking this bill is out of your financial circumstances, don't you think it's appropriate to make those disclosures to this committee as far as the state of your finances?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I would love to do that. Unfortunately, that's not within my control or power, but I can assure you they are and have been made to the attorney generals, and perhaps they, in some sense, are a surrogate for the state in that respect.
Mr. Chair.
Sure.
My understanding is that if there is a large punitive judgment award in Oregon, 60% of that is set aside for the state for the Crime Victims Fund. Isn't that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, yes.
And there's currently some uncertainty as to whether the master settlement agreement is meant to offset that obligation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, that is correct. That is an issue in one of the current appeals. And in fact, there is legislation on the House side aimed at ensuring that to protect the it was designed to protect the MSA securitization to say that if Philip Morris is successful in its argument that that's duplicative recovery under the MSA, that the MSA fund will be held harmless.
Thank you. But if Philip Morris is not successful in that argument, and if we were to pass this, and if there were a large award, essentially we would be depriving money that would go to the Oregon Crime Victims Fund if all those came through.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringdahl, I don't believe so, because this is not a cap on...
I'm sorry. Let me add one more thing. And if you subsequently went bankrupt.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringdahl, I think that that's the eventuality we're attempting to preclude or reduce the risk of. I think I could make the argument that, in fact, passage of this legislation and similar bills around the country would, in fact, if we were to lose on the issue, the substantive issue, would, in fact, increase the chance that the payment would be made into that fund, because we'd still be there to make the payment.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I mean, isn't this one of those situations where it would be great for people who live in Oregon if all the other states passed this kind of legislation, but we did not? So that we would have a greater chance of receiving a share of a large verdict.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, it is a situation where the odds of preserving the MSA payments is increased with in proportion to the number of states, particularly what I refer to as hotspot states, pass legislation like that. Well, that's unquestionably true.
Thank you.
All right. Jim, thank you. Stick around, of course. Mr. Tallman. Chuck Tallman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Chuck Tallman. I'm a lawyer in Portland, Oregon, and I guess for want of better information about me, I sue tobacco companies. And the hot spot in Oregon that Mr. Gardner referred to is simply a matter of justice being done by the courts of our state, the hardworking judges and juries, constituents of yours who sit and listen to weeks and weeks of evidence, weigh a decision, and announce their decision in a public forum. In each case that I've been involved in, the two cases that are referred to and that have come to judgment, and two class action cases that are referred to, the defendant has been Philip Morris. And the comment that Philip Morris has in the past spoken untruthfully, which was a demure understatement, has been borne out by these cases. The fact is, I'd like to set the record a little bit straight, in fact, correct the record here. I'm rather disappointed that a major law firm, Covington and Burling, that's represented Philip Morris for many years, and a local lawyer who has represented Philip Morris for many years, could make the kind of mistake that was made in the document that was submitted to you in the fourth paragraph, which is the critical paragraph that makes reference to the situation in Oregon. It says, in another Oregon case in which a class has been certified, class members are seeking to require the tobacco companies to pay to provide medical monitoring for at-risk smokers. Besides the fact that this, in fact, is fair, that a tobacco company which, for its own profits, puts its best customers at risk of death, that it's fair that they should contribute to the medical screening and monitoring. The main point I want to make here is that, as opposed to what is stated in bold print here, that case has been removed from the state courts to federal courts by Philip Morris There has been no class certified. That case is probably 2 or 3 years away from becoming an issue that is a problem that creates the kind of problem that Mr. Gardner has referred to. Quite hypothetical and certainly in the distance. And that really is the main point of my argument here today, and that is that there is no problem. There is no problem in the state of Oregon. The bill as it was drafted would have affected the bonding of the two cases that are on appeal. The amendments which raise the cap limit to $100 million make it so that those cases aren't really affected. But the fact is that what is affected by this bonding requirement, as has been pointed out in the questions, is the right of the state of Oregon to collect its appropriate and fair share under the laws that were passed by this legislature about 15 years ago, to collect its share of the punitive damages. And punitive damages, as you know, are to vindicate the public's right when conduct of an egregious nature, such as we've seen through the trial of Philip Morris in this state, occurs and is subject to all of the safeguards that we know that are part of the judicial process. But when those punitive damages are awarded, this legislature has determined that 60% of those goes to the public. In fact, more than just to the public, it goes to a specific allocation to the public, and that is to the Crime Victims Compensation Account, which is administered by the Department of Justice. By limiting the amount of the bond, as Senator Ringo suggested in his questions to Mr. Gardner, and Mr. Gardner was unable to avoid answering it, try as he might, by limiting the amount of the bond, that payment to the crime victims of this state is jeopardized. And the reason it's jeopardized is the fact that Mr. Gardner could not say here, and actually preempted that question, he could not say to you, Senators, if you pass this bill, Philip Morris will not go bankrupt. So that the disconnect between the passage of this bill and the payment of the MSA payments or the payments to the state under the punitive damages provision, there is no connect there. The fact is that if Philip Morris does go bankrupt, and if the bond is limited in such a way that there is no securitization or no security for the payment of that amount, then it is the state of Oregon and the crime victims who will suffer. Let me cover a few points briefly, and then I'll...
Chairman.
Senator.
Before you go on, could you repeat that last statement? If they go bankrupt and there's no securitization, of what amount?
Of the full amount of the judgment. The purpose here is to allow a bonding or to require a bonding only in a limited amount. So in other words, what that means is that there would, if this bill is effective at all or affects any case, it would affect a case where the judgment is larger than the bond limit. So to use an example, if the limit is $100 million but the judgment is for $150 million and Philip Morris goes bankrupt, the only recourse for the state of Oregon and for the plaintiff, but the state of Oregon, don't forget, has the majority, 60% of that judgment, the only recourse is for the bond. And if the bond is not enough to pay and Philip Morris is in bankruptcy, then in fact there is no payment, and the people who lose in that situation are the citizens of the state and really the crime victims of the state.
Mr. Tumman, help me understand this. If they can't securitize the bond and they go bankrupt, the same result occurs.
If there is a full amount of the bond.
But if they can't get the bond, let's look at the Illinois case. You've got a $12 billion judgment. If any company, tobacco or otherwise, this is focused on tobacco, but if they could not securitize that and they choose to go bankrupt, wouldn't that affect the other states that are party to the MSA?
Well, that really is a different question. The answer
is... That's not a different question at all. It's not any more hypothetical than the question that you posed to the committee.
I agree with you, Senator, and I didn't mean to to avoid the question, it's a different question than Senator Burdick asked, but I'm happy to answer that question, and that is that to use the Illinois experience in this proceeding is really a false comparison. In Illinois, there is an existing judgment. The judgment, unlike what Mr. Gardner said, is not $12 billion, although $1 billion here and $1 billion there pretty soon, as you know, it begins to add up. It's for $10 billion, $3 billion of which is in favor of the state of Illinois. And Tuesday, 2 days ago, Philip Morris went into court in Illinois to claim that because it was making payments under the Master Settlement Agreement, it should not have to pay the state of Illinois that $3 million. And in fact, in this state, in Oregon, Philip Morris has taken the same position, that no matter what happens with the bonding, that when it comes down to the actual payment, and don't forget this only happens at the end of the case, once the case is totally resolved and there's a judgment, Philip Morris has taken the position that they are urging in this court, that once that happens, they can erase that 60% that they owe to the crime victims of this state. And they do so by claiming that this is the same money that they are paying in the MSA statement, that this claim is released. The Illinois court bought this position, the same position they're taking here, that claim is released. In other words, they don't owe it. They walk away from it.
Right, Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, again, you're talking about the substance of the lawsuits, the merits of the lawsuits. You're not talking about the bond here. If I'm to understand you, what you're concerned about is those scenarios where, put the merits of the lawsuit aside, those scenarios where sometime between the posting of the bond and the final judgment on appeal, somewhere in there the company goes bankrupt. That's the scenario that you're warning about, where if the bond is not at its full level and that company goes bankrupt within that time period, then that's the scenario under which you say the Oregon fund would suffer. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that is exactly correct. That's the scenario that I'm talking about.
But to follow up, Mr. Chairman, this would have no impact, am I correct, on cases that go through the process. Say you get a $12 billion judgment in the trial court, and that's reduced to $1 billion on appeal. If the company can somehow manage not to go bankrupt before the final appeal is established, then the punitive damages in the amount of 60% still go to the state, 60% of $1 billion. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that is correct in an abstract sense, in the sense that that's what the law says, that 60% goes. Whether Philip Morris has the money, even without going bankrupt, the purpose of a bond, as opposed to what Mr. Gardner said, is not to allow the party, in this case the defendant, to make an appeal. They can appeal with or without a bond. That is not the case. It is to stay the effect of the judgment, a judgment that is considered final in this state, a judgment that has been made by a jury and has been confirmed and entered by a court, to stay the enforcement of that judgment. And a second purpose. The second purpose is, if the scenario that I am projecting, I don't believe that it will happen, but I'm not the one that raised the issue of bankruptcy. Philip Morris is the one that raised the issue of bankruptcy. If that scenario occurs, that securitizes or gives security to the prevailing party, which is the plaintiff and the state of Oregon in this instance, that there will be a fund exempt from bankruptcy. There will be a fund from which that judgment will be paid. So I suppose we're sitting here hypothesizing and projecting various different scenarios in the future. I think we have to start with the fact that a valid existing court proceeding has determined that Philip Morris owes a certain amount of money, and they owe it partially to the plaintiff and partially to the state of Oregon, and that from there we're looking at what might happen in the future. If Philip Morris were prepared to do two things. One is to say, if this bill is passed out of this committee or passed by the legislative body, it will stop Philip Morris from going bankrupt and therefore jeopardizing the MSA payments. If Philip Morris were willing to say that, that would be a different story. Secondly, if Philip Morris were willing to, in fact, instead of pleading poverty, which is an irony in itself, but instead of pleading poverty, to prove poverty, to open up their financial records to you, not necessarily to the public, but to you, so you could evaluate and have your experts and auditors evaluate whether, in fact, they're telling the truth today, that would be a completely different story. But they're not willing to do either of those things.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Tillman, I'm going to ask this question of Mr. Shepard. I understand he's going to come up and testify because the question was asked about their financial condition. And I believe Mr. Gardner said that the financial information was provided to the court under seal, but he believed that the Attorney Generals were able to view that information. I'm going to ask Mr. Shepard whether he's been able to do that. Do you know whether the AGs were a party to that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I can say, as someone famous once said, all I know is what I read in the newspapers. And what I read in the newspapers is the fact that not only is the document that they're talking about, which is the financial reports and statements of Philip Morris USA, which is the domestic tobacco company, which is not a public company. It's not like the parent company here, which has a publicly available annual reports, that this document has been submitted to the judge under seal and that Philip Morris has resisted allowing this to become unsealed. To answer your question directly, I do not believe that Philip Morris has been willing to share this information with the Attorney General's office. In fact, part of the brief of the Attorney General's to which Attorney General Myers of Oregon joined said, conditioned its effort to have the bond reduced on the proof that Philip Morris was unable itself to secure the bond. And if I may go back to a question that Mr. Chair posed about the ability to securitize a bond, there are various ways in the state of Oregon. I can't speak about Illinois law, and we've gotten sort of off on a tangent about what's happening in Illinois. But in Oregon, there are various ways that a judgment debtor, which is the situation that Philip Morris is in here, can file an undertaking. We've talked about bonds, but in fact, there are several ways that, under the statutes, that an undertaking can be posted to stay the enforcement of the judgment. One of them is through a bond, through a surety. It's expensive, there's no doubt about it. The second is through a letter of credit, which is, in fact, in our second case, the Schwarz case from Salem, the Philip Morris chose to secure their judgment through a letter of credit. The third is through any type of pledge that is considered by the court to be sufficient to back up the judgment. And the fourth way is to appeal to the court under the existing provisions in the law, either to the trial court, to the Court of Appeals, or to the Supreme Court, to examine the situation and reduce or even eliminate the bond. In fact, Philip Morris did that. When they were first in the trial court, they filed a motion to reduce the bond. They wanted to reduce the bond from, at that time, $100 million to less than $100,000. And, of course, the trial judge denied that. They did not reveal their financial records at that time, and I don't know what the judge would have done had they revealed that financial record. But these are opportunities that any judgment debtor has at every stage of the proceeding to persuade the court that they are unable to post a sufficient bond.
I have a follow-up question.
Senator Walker, then Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been a court reporter for 20 years, and I've then-president judgment debtor exams. Why doesn't somebody do a judgment debtor exam of Philip Morris?
You know, that's a very good question. I hadn't thought of it until you just mentioned it, and maybe that's the thing to do, to get Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, let me answer your question directly. It's never come up. The necessity of doing that has not come up until now when there's talk of bankruptcy, but it's an excellent idea to get someone from Philip Morris under oath in a court of law or before a court reporter and ask them these very questions and see what they're willing to say about that. That's an excellent idea.
Thank you, and you're welcome for the suggestion.
All right. Senator Burdy.
Mr. Chairman, do you happen to know, and I should bring the Philip Morris people back probably too to ask the same question, do you happen to know if that request was made in Illinois for a lowering of the bond?
It was last, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, last Tuesday, Philip Morris filed a motion with the judge who imposed the bond to, I guess as a matter of discretion, which is allowed under Illinois law as it is under Oregon law, to lower the bond. The judge had an interesting response, again, as it's been reported in the newspaper, and he said that he was constrained to discuss Philip Morris's own financial records because, as I said, they were under seal and this was an open courtroom situation. He did say that the public information that is available about the parent company, which used to be called Philip Morris Companies, but for reasons unknown to me, they changed their name to Altria. So now they're called Altria. That's a publicly traded company, and their financial records are, at least those that are required to be filed with the SEC, are open records. He questioned whether there could be some provision whether Altria itself could stand behind the judgment of Philip Morris by pledging its stock, pledging its property, doing something, purchasing a bond, doing a letter of credit, doing something that would protect its child, I guess, since that's the parent company. And thus far, the parent company has refused, not just said that they're poor, but they have refused to come in and pledge their assets to protect their subsidiary, I guess.
Right. Senator Brady.
Just to get a sense, I mean, it's my understanding just from reading the paper that typically the trial court awards are drastically reduced on appeal. Is that correct? Have you ever heard of a case where the awards stood on appeal or even were increased on appeal?
Well, the first case that is referenced in the materials from Covington and Burling is a case called Williams versus Philip Morris. That case, the jury sat through 6 weeks of testimony, found Philip Morris guilty of lying to the public, lying to the plaintiff, and awarded $80 million. The judge, in her wisdom and discretion, reduced that award to $32 million. Both sides appealed. They appealed to the Court of Appeals here in Salem, and in June of 2001, the Court of Appeals issued an opinion that reinstated the jury verdict. Now, whether that's typical or not, there have been cases reported where, in fact, jury verdicts by one stage of review or another have been reduced. There have been other cases where they've been sustained, and other cases, at least the Williams case here in Oregon, where they've actually been increased. So I think it's all across the board.
All right. Senator Ringo.
I mean, just on that point, there's another Oregon case against a car dealership where the jury awarded $1 million punitive damage. The Court of Appeals reduced it to $300,000. The Supreme Court bumped it back up to $1 million. Essentially the same type of situation. But, Mr. Thomas, I wanted to ask whether, in some ways, the condition of Philip Morris's finances cuts both ways. On the one hand, if they were to file Chapter 11 at the wrong time, depending on what scenario you paint, that could be, then it might be a good thing if we had passed But under a different scenario, if they filed Chapter 11, then Oregon would lose money. It kind of depends. What we're guessing what the scenario plays out.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, that's a very good point. We are doing some guessing here, and I think that the committee has to sort of establish some moral principles here, or at least some political principles here, and that is who has the burden of proof. Those of us who are lawyers know that we often live and die by the who has the burden of proof. There is a company, Philip Morris, that is before you today asking for special dispensation. This is not applicable to any other defendant, any other judgment creditor in the state. No other company, no other person is asked for this type of dispensation.
Although, Mr. Thomas, I think the justification for this happens to be the fact that the state's entered into the MSA.
Mr. Chair, I agree with you.
A revenue stream for the state.
I agree with you 100%. That's a battle that has already been fought. Several headlines, including the one from the Wall Street Journal, talk about the states now being addicted to these payments, and it's the truth. I agree with you 100%.
Right, and there were some attorneys on the East Coast that were enriched by the billions for their participation also.
I suppose that there were.
I know that there were.
response to the...
I guess my point there is the victims didn't get the proceeds there either. The attorneys were enriched substantially.
Well, Mr. Chair, in the sense that the victims were the states, and these were people who the states had expended tremendous amount of resources to pay for the illness and the devastation that's caused. After all, there are 6,000 of your constituents every year that die.
Mr. Tomlin, my mother died of lung cancer. She smoked from age 13. She never throughout her life ever blamed the cigarette company for her choice to smoke a cigarette. That's a different philosophical view. I didn't blame the cigarette companies for my mother's choice to smoke cigarettes.
You know, Mr. Chair, we could get into philosophical discussions about choice, but it's probably not the place or the right time to do that.
Right. I mean, we want to talk about justice and so on and so forth. Again, my mother was a mother. She grew up in Kansas, smoked from age 13. Again, tough woman, never complained. Died of lung cancer. She didn't blame everybody else for all of her problems. I watched her die. You know, frankly, I think there's a view here where some people go after those people that are viewed to have big pockets, but there's also motivation on the part of some private litigation companies, firms, to enrich themselves to the detriment of the states. And I do believe there's a substantial argument to be made and substantial proof that some attorneys were enriched way beyond the effort that they put in.
Mr. Chair, I can't comment on that. I tend to agree with you in terms of...
I think one of them was a brother-in-law of a particular attorney general from the East Coast State.
You know, I don't know the answer to that, honestly, but I tend to agree with you that there were lawyers certainly who were enriched by this. Just for the record, the money that was paid to the lawyers was paid over and above the amount that was paid to the states. And so Philip Morris actually paid that money, not Philip Morris, but all of the manufacturers actually paid that money to the lawyers. I did want to also, for the record, state that at least my clients, Jesse Williams, who was an African-American janitor for the school district in Portland, and Michelle Schwarz, who was a wife of a physician here in Salem, they went into court and they said to the jury and to the judge and to Philip Morris, we are responsible for our own deaths and injuries. We are responsible. They said it in writing. They said it to the jury. They said, we are responsible. So when we talk about personal responsibility, Mr. Chair, they said to the jury, we are responsible. The jury then had to find out whether the other party bore any responsibility, any at all, for all of their years of lies, of deceit, of profit-making. And the jury found, in fact, in both of those cases, a very common-sense approach. And the jury said, you're both responsible. And we admitted that we were responsible. The jury said, you're both responsible. It's 50-50, and under our laws, that's the way that the question is put to the jury, and the jury found that, yes, you, the smoker, are responsible But yes, you, Philip Morris, are also responsible. And that's how those two cases ended. And we were very proud of that, the fact that an Oregon jury had that common sense to look at that and find both parties responsible. Only one sought to avoid responsibility. It wasn't the plaintiff. It wasn't the smoker. The smoker admitted responsibility.
Well, Mr. Tomlin, I appreciate all of your comments, but I just have to respectfully disagree with the motivation in particular. Any other questions? Senator Burdick.
To get back to the bond issue, if we could have a system in Oregon where the judge would have access, and maybe even the attorneys on both sides could have access to the actual financial records, would you be comfortable with a provision that would allow the judge to impose, say, a cap like we're talking about on the bond if it was justified by the financial records?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I would go even further than that, because I would say that if the court had access to this data, I would say that the court would be able not only to limit the bond to the amount that's being discussed here, the court should be able to reduce it even further or to eliminate a bond entirely. In fact, the law in Illinois that was proposed to protect Philip Morris, which, by the way, was rejected by Philip Morris, the law in Illinois set three principles, three factors. And if you'll indulge me a minute, I'll hopefully I can find them quickly. The law in Illinois that was proposed just last week, but was as a compromise to try to bring this to a closure in Illinois and protect Philip Morris, said that the trial judge's discretion to limit the bond amount to not less than 10% of the total judgment if the trial judge made three findings. In other words, this was open to the parties to argue and to submit evidence in favor or against these findings. One, that the size of the bond would cause the defendant undue financial hardship. That's the issue that we are just discussing about the financial data. Two, that the defendant had sufficient assets to pay the judgment. And three, that the defendant wouldn't move financial assets around in order to avoid paying the judgment if the case were lost on appeal. That was the compromise that was proposed in Illinois, and that was the compromise that Philip Morris rejected in Illinois. So this type of situation where the trial court were given discretion and full disclosure would be fine. Quite frankly, we have that under our current law, but to make it a special situation for tobacco companies, I think would be entirely appropriate.
But, and again, I just make a point for the committee, and hopefully I'm right on this, that even if you did have a cap as proposed in this bill, all it does is stay the effect of that until the case runs through the system and reaches its ultimate conclusion at the Supreme Court. So if, in fact, the judgment is upheld at the highest level, then all of the effects of the judgment, the enforcement of the judgment...
Mr. Chair, in legal terms, yes. In practical terms, if in the meantime, and now we're getting back to the guessing about scenario, if in the meantime Philip Morris became, either through bankruptcy or otherwise, just lack of assets, became unable to pay the judgment,
right,
there would be no one would stand in magically and say, here it is.
Right. But see, and this is getting to my point, actually. It seems to me, obviously I haven't looked at their financial records either, but it seems to me that there may come a point where the cash flow and the ability for Philip Morris or any other tobacco company to do business, because the MSA is really contingent upon the cash flow of the corporation, the business, not assets in a sense that they own buildings or land that securitize these payments, but rather the continuation of those entities in business really is what generates or securitizes the MSA. If we jeopardize their ability to do business and they no longer do business, then that creates an even bigger problem, it seems to me.
Mr. Chair, let me make two very brief comments about that, because that's a very, very good point, one that's been made in the press continually. Some call it the states being addicted or in bed with the cigarette companies, but in reality, that's where we are. I mean, I can't argue against that. That was a fight that happened a couple of years ago. One is that testimony in the Schwarz case, under oath by Philip Morris, this is not by the plaintiff, but testimony by one of their employees, their director of marketing, was that at the time the MSA was entered into, Philip Morris raised the price of their cigarettes in an amount sufficient to amortize all payments under the MSA. In other words, they said to the consumer, this is going to be your burden, and not only are we raising the price enough to pay for the first year, but they raised the price enough, according to their testimony, to amortize 25 years of payments to the states. And the second point I forgot, so.
I do that, too. I'm sorry, those comments were made where?
Those comments were made by Nancy Lund, L-U-N-D, the director of marketing. I can produce the transcript for you. It was under questioning. I don't even remember whether it was by us or by her own lawyer. They made a big deal out of the MSA in the sense of trying to show the jury that they had been punished already.
Mr. Chair.
All right, Senator
Walker. I would ask if you could provide that portion of the transcript. My son collects all the lies made by the cigarette companies, and I'd love to add it to his collection.
Mr. Chair. Well, I think that, Senator Walker, I think that was actually the truth.
That one's the truth.
Done that. The question is, why are they saying now that they can't afford it when they've already shifted the burden to the consumer?
Yeah. Of course, you wouldn't be able to collect all the lies ever told by government, would you?
No.
Senator Ringo.
What information do you have about Philip Morris's finances? Retained earnings? Gross receipts?
There's a limited amount of information that comes from the reporting in the annual report of the parent company. Mm-hmm. And it's extraordinary information. There's some $10 billion a year that's earned in gross profits. I do happen to have access to a confidential sealed document that if Philip Morris were willing to agree to its release, I would be happy to release to you, but under its current circumstances, even though I have it in my briefcase, I would get in a lot of trouble for releasing it. And it is the 2001 financial report, whereas the one that was sealed in Illinois that Philip Morris is refusing to release is the current 2002 financial documents. So I'm not qualified, I'm not an accountant or an auditor to look at this and say whether, in fact, this justifies imposing this level of bond. But the judge did. The interesting thing is that in Illinois, the judge had access to the information, and he's the one that imposed that $12 billion bond.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
So you have this in your briefcase right there,
correct,
right now, the 2001 financial report.
Correct.
Oh, Mr. Chair,
I can't have it.
I know, neither can you. But I guess I'd like to ask Mr. Gardner whether we can't look at it. I mean, because we're being asked to make a decision based on their financial condition, and they're keeping it in a sealed envelope.
Well, okay, we'll have Mr. Gardner come back up. This is an interesting, almost academic discussion in my thinking, that we're really talking about putting a cap on the appeal bond. It does not affect the ultimate judgment. It stays it. That's true. So all of the stuff we're talking about, I mean, a lot of hypotheticals and stuff, and you know, the condition of the company. But and I think there is some, because they raised the issue, the potential or possible bankruptcy of the company is an issue. I guess I don't know how we get there with respect to not just Philip Morris, but any other tobacco company that's party to it too.
Mr. Chair, I think the tricky thing is, the fact that they're raising bankruptcy as rationale for the bill may be the best argument against the bill.
Spoken like a true lawyer.
Mr. Chair, you know, my experience in bankruptcy court the past 20 years, bankruptcy might not be such a bad idea. You can get the court to appoint an examiner. You can get the court to appoint a trustee in a Chapter 11 and take the debtor out of possession. I think that would be awesome. In my work with trustees, they're quite tenacious because they get a percentage of whatever they take in. So that, just like attorneys, so that prospect actually doesn't frighten me all that much, other than the fees associated with bankruptcies are pretty high. You have to pay quarterly fees to the U.S. trustee and all kinds of other fees that kind of eat into the estate. But it would take it out of the hands of the very company who's not being very forthright. And I kind of find that fascinating. And I would think any bankruptcy judge would just be delighted to get that case.
Mr. Thomas got a big Jesse Cat grin on his face. Seems to think it would be a good idea, too, I think. All right. Anybody else have a question? We need to kind of move on. I want to get Mr. Shepard up here and hear what the Attorney General's office has to say about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Appreciate you being a good sport. You ever put up with cranky judges, by the way?
Never. I never put up with them.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. As I reflected on this bill and on the testimony that I was going to provide to the committee, I tried to think how I could best be helpful to the committee, and I think there are basically two points that I can help the committee with, the first being somewhat helpful and the second probably being more helpful to in the committee's deliberations. The first has to do with what much of the discussion is concerned, and that is the state's competing fiscal interests in the potential implications of the bill. And then the point on which I think I can be probably more helpful to the committee is giving you a little bit of a, in part a review and in part some new information about this very complicated legal landscape that in which this debate is taking place. To the first point, the question of competing fiscal interests. These interests do, as you have already learned this morning, tug in really two different directions. The first of the fiscal interests is that the proposed cap is a potential threat to the state's fiscal interest in the punitive damage portion of these judgments. That clearly is a potential risk because you've learned the state does have, by law, a interest to the extent of 60% of punitive damages that are awarded. And as you've already heard this morning, the existence of a bond could also benefit the state in securing or in making it easier for us to collect that share of the punitive damages. An Oregon verdict large enough to be a contributory factor in a bankruptcy is also a potential threat to the state's fiscal interest. And that arises out of the potential impact, if you hypothesize an Oregon verdict large enough to be a contributory factor in a bankruptcy proceeding, the bankruptcy proceeding will impair or impede or perhaps defeat the state's capacity to collect its share under the Master Settlement Agreement, or the share that would otherwise have been paid. And I'll discuss that in a little more detail in a few minutes. In our judgment, and it is a judgment, the proposed cap, the threat posed by the proposed cap, is the more immediate of the two risks, and therefore we oppose the printed bill, and we would not support the bill.
Senator Burdick.
Does that include the amendment raising the cap to $100 million?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, it does. And to anticipate a question that you haven't asked, but I think it's looming large, is there some number that the Attorney General would be find acceptable? And I think the answer to that is yes. I don't know where that is. I think $100 million is too small. Sort of the principle that we would look at is how large is it that we can anticipate, how big a verdict would we want to be sure can be protected with the bond, and yet not be so huge as to almost approach the absurd, which I think, goes to the part of the reason why we subscribe to the amicus brief in the Illinois proceeding, because in Illinois, not only does the bond cause a stay in the proceedings, but in Illinois, unlike Oregon, the requirement of posting that security on appeal is also the key to the appellate courthouse door. That is, without posting that security in Illinois, the party can't bring the appeal. And as the chair has noted and the committee has already discussed this morning, in Oregon, the bond causes a stay in collection efforts, but does not, the right of a party to seek an appeal is not conditioned on posting that bond.
Yes,
I'd like to get your comment. You handed out this letter from Philip Morris, and it said that the $12 billion actually exceeds, unless my math is even worse than I thought, it actually exceeds slightly the judgment. And Philip Morris claims that they have shown the judge information that shows they're not able to make the bond. Mr. Talman testified that there is a process whereby the judge can take information into account and lower the bond. Do you have any, are you familiar enough with this case to opine on why the bond wasn't lowered or where the truth is in this matter?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, the direct answer to your question is that that's still a pending question with the trial court in Illinois. That has not been decided finally in the Illinois court.
I was not aware of that.
And so, I couldn't give you anything other than just a guesstimate, really, as and even that would be ill-informed as to whether the judge is likely to do that or not in the Illinois proceeding.
Pete, did you provide this document for Philip Morris?
Mr. Chair, yes, I did.
The plaintiff's counsel is going to receive $1.775 billion. Is that a contingency fee arrangement, do you know?
Mr. Chair, I think that was a determination by the trial judge in Illinois. I don't know what principle.
I'd like to know at some point what that represents in terms of actual hours spent by the plaintiff's counsel.
Mr. Chair, we don't have that I don't have that information.
Right. I assume somebody would somewhere.
Let me turn to the area where I think I can probably be of more help to the committee other than just stating our judgment on the risk assessment, and that is to give you a little bit of a overview of some of these issues, the legal landscape, the $12 billion issue in the Miles case in Illinois. That is pending, and as I've noted, the Illinois law with respect to that is a little different than Oregon in that part of the issue in Illinois is not just whether there will be some form of stay pending the appeal, but whether Philip Morris is entitled to bring the substantive appeal or not. And so that is somewhat different than the landscape in Oregon. Philip Morris did respond with the letter that I provided to the committee here. This letter was received by the Attorneys General on the 27th of March. And I do want to draw your attention as you think about the risks here to the very specific and careful language of the letter in the second paragraph, the last sentence. Because of the extraordinary amount of the bond presently required by the Madison County trial judge, it is presently uncertain whether Philip Morris USA will be able to make the payment under the master settlement agreement that otherwise would be due April 15th. That payment, Philip Morris's share of the payments that are due April 15th in total, is about $2.6 billion. Oregon's share in turn of that payment is just a hair under $30 million. So that's the payment that's referenced in the paragraph there. And I point that language out because it's been our experience in dealing with these companies that they are very ably represented both here and nationally. And this letter very carefully does not say that Philip Morris will declare bankruptcy in the event it's required to make both of these payments, both the bond and the master settlement agreement payment. Mr. Gardner, I noted, was also careful not to make that claim.
Senator Walker.
Mr. Shepard, in the next paragraph, It also says, unfortunately, efforts to date have been unavailing in persuading the Illinois legislature to pass reasonable bond cap legislation. So they haven't been able to get Illinois to do that, but they're coming to all the peripheral states that are part of the MSA to do that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, it's correct that the Illinois legislature has considered, and it's my understanding is still considering possible legislation with respect to the bond. And it's also correct that Philip Morris is asking other state legislatures to adopt caps. That's my understanding.
So Illinois hasn't made a final decision on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, it is my understanding that there is still discussion in Illinois about a potential political resolution in the form of some form of legislation. That still is there have been various proposals, as I understand it, they've been proposed and disposed of there, but the issue is still a live issue in Illinois.
I have another question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shepard, you indicated in your testimony that the difference with Illinois is that they require the bond amount in order to open the door to get into appeals court. Why hasn't the Illinois legislature just considered unlocking that door and not making it a requirement such as Oregon does, and then we can just avoid all this stuff about the bond?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I'm afraid I don't have enough information about what's been before the Illinois legislature to know what their reasoning is.
You're not privy to whether they've had that discussion or not. Maybe Mr. Gardner might know that. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me just briefly describe a little bit more about the status of the Illinois proceedings. As has been alluded to, the court does have under advisement in Illinois a request from Philip Morris to reduce the amount of the bond. The most recent development there this week was that the judge instructed Philip Morris and the plaintiffs in that case to engage in negotiations in an effort to arrive at a negotiated resolution as between Philip Morris and the plaintiffs, which would reduce the amount of bond or the amount of security required in the Illinois proceeding. And then there is the legislative potential action. So there are several ways in which the Illinois dispute might be resolved in the short run. By some form of resolution in those cases. The judge indicated to the parties, evidently, that he expected the parties to conclude their negotiations this week and that he would decide on Friday, as early as Friday of this week, whether to reduce the bond. So it's possible that tomorrow we'll have some resolution from Illinois. In Oregon, there are some cases working their way through the system which implicate the state's fiscal interest in punitive damages. The Williams case and the Schwartz case are the two that you've heard. The Williams case is much further along in the process than the Schwartz case. In Williams, the state court appellate process has been completed. Philip Morris has indicated to us that they may petition the United States Supreme Court for review of the judgment in the Williams case, but to our knowledge, those petitions have not yet been filed by Philip Morris with the United States Supreme Court. And Schwartz is still at the relatively early stage of the state court appellate proceedings. Let me mention just one very, very briefly one important United States Supreme Court case that was decided early this week or late last week that has some relevance to assessing the magnitude of the state share of the punitive damages, and that's a case involving State Farm Insurance, State Farm Insurance versus Campbell, or Campbell versus State Farm Insurance. In that case, the United States Supreme Court found that a verdict of $145 million in punitive damages to roughly $1 million in compensatory damages was a violation of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. The court hinted in that case that it considered a single-digit ratio between punitive damages and compensatory damages to be the outside limit of the Due Process Clause. It didn't actually announce that as a one-size-fits-all rule, so I can't represent to you that inevitably that decision will cause reductions in the Williams and Schwartz judgments. The Supreme Court did not announce such an inflexible rule, but it clearly signaled that there are some stricter limits on the magnitude of punitive damages than we had thought before the court announced its opinion. And that could have implications potentially both for the magnitude of the Schwartz and Williams judgments. Finally, as you assess what the risks are of various courses of action, you may want to know something about what does happen, particularly with respect to the Master Settlement Agreement proceeds, if there is a bankruptcy filed. And let me conclude with just a couple of points about that. First of all, the form of the bankruptcy filing would most likely be the form, Chapter 11, you've heard it alluded to, in which a company seeks the protection of the bankruptcy court but nonetheless continues to operate. And if that takes place, then there are a lot of uncertainties, but one of the certainties is that the payments that Philip Morris otherwise would make to Oregon and to the other states certainly would be delayed and potentially would be ultimately reduced. We also know that the marketing requirements of the Master Settlement Agreement would continue to be in force. And in all the discussion of the dollars here, it's easy to forget that the reason that the states brought this case in the first place was because of the conduct of these companies in the marketplace, and most particularly for Oregon, with respect to marketing to underage consumers of these products. And so we're very confident that those marketing restrictions will continue to be in place. Oregon and the other states have been preparing against this eventuality for some years. The National Association of Attorneys General has receives funds under the Master Settlement Agreement, and some of those funds have been used during the past several years to hire National Bankruptcy Counsel. And in conjunction with the other states, Oregon has been working with that council to make sure that we're prepared for the eventuality of a bankruptcy. And part of that preparation is to form a committee, because one of the things that will happen in a bankruptcy proceeding is that creditors of similar type will be formed up into committees of like interest to represent the group's interests, in effect, in the bankruptcy proceedings. And the states will be, if not the largest, at least one of the largest creditors committees in any bankruptcy proceeding. And therefore, we think we will have a lot of say over the structure of that bankruptcy proceeding. And finally, let me close with just one observation about a very early decision that the any company entering bankruptcy would need to make, and that is the question of whether it would reaffirm a commitment that it has that otherwise might be impaired or scrubbed off in the course of the bankruptcy. And in particular, the question would be whether Philip Morris would reaffirm the Master Settlement Agreement. If it did, the payments would continue under the terms of that agreement. And, of course, it would require court approval. And there are reasons to think that a tobacco company entering a bankruptcy proceeding would reaffirm. In part, our judgment is that a tobacco company entering a bankruptcy proceeding will thereafter be treated as a non-participating manufacturer. And Oregon has, as other states do, a statute that places burdens upon NPMs, as they're referred to, that are intended to approximate the magnitude of the burden that that company would endure if it were a Master Settlement Agreement participating company. And so there may not be any economic advantage to a company being in the going through the bankruptcy proceeding. And second, under the Master Settlement Agreement, disputes about the propriety of advertising and other industry practices, which again take you back to the underlying reason for Oregon's participation in the litigation in the first place, those are at the core of Oregon's interest in seeing the Master Settlement Agreement be enforced. Under the Master Settlement Agreement, those disputes are all brought to one central forum through the National Association of Attorneys General and discussed at a national level. A company that's in bankruptcy or that emerges from bankruptcy as a non-participating manufacturer must deal on a state-by-state basis across the nation with 50 different attorneys general's ideas of what those attorneys general believe the state law requires with respect to marketing their products. And so there may be a very great incentive for a company, even one that's gone all the way through the bankruptcy proceeding, to subsequently rejoin the Master Settlement Agreement.
All right. We're having fun now, aren't we?
Yeah.
All right. Senator Burdick and Senator Walker. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Engel.
You indicated earlier that there could be a level of cap that the Attorney General might support on that. Could I pin you down a little bit on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I would be pleased to engage in that discussion with the committee. I very briefly discussed it with the Attorney General, and we do not have any specific number to suggest to you this morning. But if the committee's desire is to have that discussion, I can get more direction.
Okay, to follow up, Mr. Chairman, in your view, if a bond posted in Oregon without any cap at all, if legislation were just to be put aside, if a bond were to be ordered in Oregon, that really would jeopardize a tobacco company to the point of precipitating bankruptcy. In your view, are Oregon laws adequate to allow judges to remedy that situation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, yes, I believe that under current law, a trial judge has authority under those circumstances to reduce the amount of the bond.
Thank you. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shepherd, you raised some very good points about why Philip Morris probably doesn't want to go into bankruptcy, and that was exactly my point as well. That's why I'm fascinated that we could get into bankruptcy. You know, as well as I do, that once a bankruptcy is filed, all collection action on all debts is stayed. So if there's payment due under the MSA, that is stopped temporarily during the bankruptcy until it's reinstated by the court, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes, I think I indicated that the certain thing about bankruptcy is that it will delay payment.
Right, but it could reinstate the payment once the court makes the decision that it's in the best interest of the estate to do so.
Mr. Correct? Chair, Senator Walker, that's one of the potentials.
Okay. And then my other question for you is, have you seen the financial information that's under seal in the court of Illinois?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, on that point, what I can tell the committee is that the Oregon Attorney General's office has not received that information. I don't know, of my own knowledge, whether the information has been shared with any other individual attorney general. I do know that information was filed under seal with the court, as has been described. I do not know whether the National Association of Attorneys General or any of its representatives have had an opportunity to review the materials that are on file with the court. I just don't know one way or the other on that question.
Then my question would be, Mr. Chair, Mr. Shepherd, do you know if anyone has requested the opportunity to view it from the AG's office here in Oregon and or through the National Association?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, it's my understanding that in the Illinois proceeding, the part of, and I think Mr. Talman alluded to this, that part of the amicus brief that we filed suggested that the information that the court had under seal would be relevant in that determination. Whether somebody from the Attorneys General have said directly to Philip Morris, show us your whole card, so to speak, I don't know whether that specific request has gone forward. It's clearly, the state's position clearly is that the trial judge in Illinois should have access to all of that information as he makes the determination on the amount of the bond.
And my final question, Mr. Chair?
How many do you have?
That's it.
That's it?
Yeah, that's it. My final question.
Problem?
Final point.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
Has the state ever considered requesting a judgment debtor exam of Philip Morris?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we haven't had any need to do anything like that because to date Philip Morris and all of the companies have been timely in their payments, and so there hasn't been any necessity of doing any such exam. You raise an interesting question, and I frankly don't know whether we would have authority to order or to seek a judgment debtor exam at this point, because the way that the tobacco litigation was settled was by entry of a consent decree, and then a separate settlement agreement between the companies and the state. And so I would have to look more closely at the question of whether we actually qualify as a judgment creditor in that sense for the sufficiently to give us the authority to order a judgment debtor exam. We might. I don't know the answer.
Okay.
But we haven't needed to until this point, and indeed we won't know whether we need to consider such an option until April 16th. Then we find out whether the company makes its payment as it's obliged to do on the 15th.
Okay. Right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In pursuing the question as to what is the right amount of, say, that we should put into this bill, I assume that you would need to have Philip Morris's complete financial information.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I think that certainly would be important for us to know, because the fundamental argument is where are the outer limits beyond which a bond constitutes, in effect, sort of a substantive impairment of someone's right to get review. The Oregon law doesn't operate the same way as Illinois law, as I described, but it could have that practical effect if it reached a certain magnitude. So I think that we would want to inform our discussions of where that limit, where the principal number is, with at the maximum amount of information about what it might be in a specific case.
And just to follow up, so and what information do you have right now? What financial information do you have on Philip Morris?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, we have, as to Oregon specific information, we only have public record information. The information that's available publicly.
I see. Okay. So you don't have any confidential information on Philip Morris's financial condition.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, that's correct. The caveat is the unknown for me is whether the National Association of Attorneys Generals, or the lead states that have been dealing specifically with the Illinois proceedings, it is possible that they have looked at the materials that are on file with the court. Beyond that, Oregon does not even constructively have access to confidential financial information.
All right. One more? Two more?
Well, how can this committee know what figure to put into this bill without having at least some better financial information, some basis to make that decision?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I think that's a legitimate question, and I don't think I think it's difficult to identify a principled answer to the magnitude of the cap, if there is to be one, without having an idea of that information.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I'll get back to my central point. A couple of things that raised. $1.775 billion in remuneration to the plaintiff's counsel is very fascinating, because some rudimentary numbers provided to me. Roughly, if you had 200 attorneys working for 3 years, 40 hours a week, it would amount to $1,400 an hour. I introduced a bill, by the way, to prohibit such contingency fee agreements by the Attorney General of the State of Oregon, particularly as it relates to hiring outside counsel. I think they ought to be remunerated based on their actual worth, which is their hourly rate. But
opposed to
sending them off.
If they lost, they wouldn't have got a nickel.
That may or may not be true, depending upon the contingency fee agreement or how that's structured, because I know that can be structured differently. The other question that I want to raise to you is, when we get into this morass of bankruptcy, et cetera, et cetera, you talk about marketing restrictions. Now, those marketing restrictions are, I assume, part of the agreement between the tobacco companies and the settlement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it occurs to me that Oregon has a very broad and extensive First Amendment privilege that extends to corporations. So, on the other side of the discussion is that, you know, given a transition or a movement away from the MSA, that there are certain First Amendment privileges,
Mr.
and
Chair,
risks that they may take, I guess, in going down that path.
Mr. Chair, my point was that even in the bankruptcy proceeding, the restrictions are not of the our ability to enforce the restrictions of the Master Settlement Agreement against a company that is in bankruptcy, in our judgment, would not be impaired by the stay that would prohibit us from collecting enforcing the financial aspects.
Right.
And in respect to your point about the company's free expression, that was one of the very important achievements of the Master Settlement Agreement, in that because it was an agreement, it was not the imposition of a governmental regulation on speech. It was an agreement by the companies to restrain their speech, in effect, or to restrain their expression. Right. So, and because it was an agreement, arguably the restrictions go further than those that we could get a court to order.
Right, and you said that if Philip Morris entered into a bankruptcy proceeding, you would consider them a non-participating manufacturer.
For purposes of the financial requirements, that's right.
Right, but interesting. I think it raises a bunch of interesting questions about what the company could do. And clearly, I haven't a clue. They'd make fascinating arguments or discussions about free speech and government's interventions, et cetera, et cetera. Mr. Gardner, do you want to say anything? Close, you've listened to all of this.
May I have Mr. Nelson join me as well?
You bet.
I want to respond to a couple of the key points here. We're really, I think, Mr. Shepard indicated $100 million is too high. We originally had this bill at $25 million. We're really kind of down to the process of...
It was too low.
We're down to the point of figuring out the amount, and I would simply say that $100 million is the top end for these kinds of statutes that have been passed all across the country. Some of them are as low as $5 million. I believe that's Idaho, but $100 million is at the top end. With regard to confidential financial information, in the letter that Mr. Shepard distributed from Philip Morris to Christine Gregoire, who is the AG of Washington, I would draw your attention to the third paragraph's first two sentences. Philip Morris USA is not financially able to post the enormous bond that the Madison County Court has demanded. In this regard, we are prepared to share with you, subject to appropriate confidentiality, non-public Philip Morris USA financial information demonstrating that Philip Morris USA is unable to post a bond in such an amount. And that offer, I am certain, is available to all AGs on the same terms. If a particular AG has not availed himself or herself of it, perhaps it might be appropriate to do so. There was a discussion about the shift to consumers through a price increase of the amount of the MSA payment. I think it's clear that that did happen. But what that didn't do was to cover amounts of these enormous judgments above and beyond the MSA payments. And when the discussion was made of amortizing 25 years, it was amortizing it on a year-by-year basis, not that you'd get the entire amount up front in one massive price increase to cover 25 years of MSA payments. Clearly, it is to cover the cost of the MSA payments, but not to cover the cost of $12 to $100 billion plus jury verdicts, of which a very substantial portion is plaintiff's attorney fees. Now, in Oregon, a bond stays execution. It is not a, quote, key to the appellate courthouse door. It's a stay of execution. But as a practical matter, that's the same thing, because if you don't post the bond or otherwise post a security to stay execution of the judgment, your assets are going to be seized and sold while you're in the process of appealing. So as a practical matter, it amounts to the same thing. One interesting thing that Mr. Taubman did say, and it affects also some comments that Mr. Shepard had a bit later on, if you look at the Covington memo, cases in Oregon that have gone to verdict, where there has been a trial court judgment, would not, and I would ask Mr. Talman to correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe I'm correct, would not be affected by a cap at $100 million. What this is really aimed at is an Illinois level, a catastrophic judgment that is in excess of $100 million. And $100 million, as I mentioned before, is the high end of other state statutes that have issued these supersedious bond limits. And finally, I want to reflect on a very interesting comment that Mr. Shepard made about that if Chapter 11 occurs, that might push the state participating manufacturers into NPM status. Well, there's a really interesting thing about being an NPM, a non-participating manufacturer. We have a law that applies to those people in Oregon, and what it requires is payment into escrow of an amount aimed at sort of approximating what the MSA payment would be. But you know what about that payment? It stays in escrow for a period of time. I believe it's 25 years. And guess what happens to that money at the end of the 25 years? You think the state gets it? Goes back to the manufacturer. So I find it very puzzling that would be held out as a sort of an onerous alternative that would be unattractive to a participating manufacturer. And finally, I want to just read one sentence. This is from the amicus brief signed by the Attorney General of Oregon and other AGs around the country in support of the motion to reduce the bond in the state of Illinois. Based on the notification by Philip Morris to state attorneys general, the $12 billion appeal bond threatens the April 15th payment and thus would disrupt vital governmental programs of the states. That's a quote from their brief.
Who wrote the brief?
The brief was filed on behalf of Hardy Myers and other AGs and the law firm. I can furnish copies of
it. It's outside counsel.
Yes, Lewis, Rice, and Fingerish in Belleville, Illinois. They were acting as counsel for the various AGs on the amicus brief. Hmm. So that's what they're saying in the state of Illinois. Hmm. I think this is, as I said at the very beginning, I can't guarantee that if this bill is passed, the MSA money will keep coming. I can only say that if we are successful in enough states, particularly the hotspot states, in putting reasonable limits on the bond, appellate bond amounts, the chances are enhanced that we will be able to continue making the payments to the state. And the simple truth is the state of Oregon and other states have got as much stake in this as we do. Like it or not, you are our financial partners in ensuring the continuing viability of the MSA payment.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Farioli, you've got a question. Now, we're not only partners, by the way, in terms of the financial side of the thing. It seems to me that the MSA was, as Mr. Shepard stated, much broader than that in terms of marketing restrictions, et cetera, that the states have an interest in, assume, in terms of the negotiations. So, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not a question, but a statement. You know, we expect the tobacco companies to honor their settlement agreements. Matter of fact, we absolutely depend on it, since that's supporting a lot of our state programs. There's no limitation on continuing tobacco litigation, and there are no liability limits. And then we require these bond limitations on settlement agreements, or at least these bond requirements to be met, and are ready to accuse the tobacco companies potentially for evading their responsibility by using the vehicle of bankruptcy. We acknowledge that the courts funding the tobacco companies withheld health effects data. I mean, we acknowledge that the courts have found that the tobacco companies withheld health effects data, and so we have really no reason to be blindly trusting of the tobacco companies when they make assertions about their financial condition. If we fail to make a decision to balance the whole question to help these companies avoid bankruptcy, there will be no continuing payments for the MSA, because they will use the vehicle of bankruptcy. no capacity means no justice for those people that have been injured by the use of the product. So we don't act, it's not, I mean, if we do act, I don't think it's to protect the interests of the tobacco companies, but certainly if we don't protect their capacity to mitigate the damage they've done, how do we protect the injured? It's like fishing with a cormorant. You know, if the little ring on the cormorant's neck is too tight, the bird starves, and this is a very efficient fisher. If the ring is too loose, the cormorant gets away, and you lost your capacity to bring back the benefits. I'm persuaded that we need to make a balance point and take the action, if nothing else, not to protect the tobacco companies, but to protect the injured.
All right. Mr. Nelson, we'll get back to you at some future time. We're going to go ahead and close this. I've lost my entire committee.
Mr. Chairman, this is fascinating.